So as we go back down onto the ground level, there is still no shortage of strangeness to be found, like these huge slabs of diorite that have scoop marks and perfect vertical lines going down the body. No chisel marks, no chipped areas, just smooth lines going down. Once again, as if someone had scraped a tool across its surface and somehow scooped away some of the diorite. I also don't know if this is bedrock or something else. The grooves go down beyond the earth line, so this could very well continue on, but I mean, it hasn't been excavated, and I saw absolutely no one coming over here to look at it. One of the weirdest examples of manipulating and removing incredibly hard stone without evidence of Bronze Age tools, and it's just sitting here, being politely ignored by 99.9% of the tourists, and according to Camille, she's never seen a local guide bringing people up here to take a look at it.
See, just took him right past this one. Took him right past.
And it's got various grooves and channels in the top of the stone as well. It's not just these scoop marks, but on top of it, there's all sorts of strange channels and grooves and cuts, but nothing here would signify stone quarrying. It just looks like someone was messing around with the stone. How and for what reason, we don't know. So I'm not really trying to provide you with answers. I'm trying to highlight the fact that we don't have good answers. We still have a ton of questions. All right, so we look at these places, we have theories, we have ideas, we have opposition to the mainstream model, but all of this is just a question mark. Nobody's got a definitive reason for how they were scooping the stone or softening the stone, and no one's got a definitive reason for the stone nubs. Nobody's got a reason for the requirement of this incredible megalithic force-resistant interlocking architecture. It's not about really gaining answers right now, more so about trying to find the higher fidelity questions. What are the better questions that we need to be asking? Clearly this area was special. The bedrock itself has been dressed and smoothed down and worked and formed into some very strange patterns all the way around this particular area, but why the nubs? I feel like the nubs protruding from bedrock is a big issue. It's a big issue for both the mainstream and also the alternative explanations. Clearly these are not lifting points, like the mainstream says. But the equally placed challenge on the idea that all of the blocks were cast from liquid artificial stone, and that the nubs are an after effect or component of that process, because why are they on the bedrock if they're an element of a casting process where you're using a mold? Another issue I have with the casting theory, especially in Peru, is the fact that essentially each polygonal block used in ancient megalithic stone building in Peru is a different shape. They all fit together in incredible ways, but none of them are identical, so you would need a mold for each block shape variation. That is an incomprehensible amount of molds. And also, where are they all now? Where are the cast molds? Where are the like leftover shells of the molds? Like, I don't see a whole lot of evidence for that, personally. But there are areas that raise that question. It's not to be dismissed entirely. I just don't think it explains all of the various architectural anomalies in Peru and Egypt and India and Turkey and Greece. I don't think casting and molding explains everything. I think it's a little bit unintelligent to kind of just say, oh yeah, it's cast. Okay? Like, not everything is cast. I think the bedrock stone nubs do challenge this idea, but I absolutely hold space for some element of stone softening or use of a novel stone mixture, like the whole theory behind molding these artificial granites and artificial diorites into other structures as almost like a veneer, like a plaster on, like a plasterboard. It's possible. Around the corner, we see various pens or foundations from Inca times, again with rough cut stone, mud and mortar binding each one together. But these Inca work have been built around some very strange pockets of advanced bedrock and megalithic work. Another example of the Inca venerating and respecting the previous work and building their own structures around it. Because once again, this is a diorite, it's incredibly hard. And what we see is, frankly, astonishing huge chambers of excavated bedrock. Polished to a fine shine, perhaps even displaying signatures of vitrification, but removed from the bedrock with such incredible precision. Again, no tool marks, no chisel marks. It stands out amongst all of the simple stone walls around it. You know, it's something of a completely different order of magnitude and skill. And continuously, we are just left wondering, why? Why do this? This would be such a huge physical undertaking. And the tools we believe were being used couldn't possibly have been used. And so this is either tremendously difficult, but extremely important for whoever was doing it, or it was tremendously easy. And honestly, I'm starting to believe that whoever was making these marks in the bedrock didn't consider it to be that much of a challenge. The amount of examples we find across Peru of this level of stonework would suggest that this was something being done quite regularly. And yet the Bronze Age tools wouldn't allow for this to be done regularly, so we must invoke different tools. And also, the Bronze Age Inca culture didn't exist for long enough to be putting so much man hours into chiseling andesite and granite and diorite. You know, people make the argument in Egypt for that. Oh, well, it's just a lot of slaves and a lot of time and a lot of effort. Even that's really dumb. It is really dumb. But you can try and invoke it because they've got thousands of years worth of culture. The Inca don't have thousands of years worth of culture. So they don't have the expanses of time required to dedicate themselves to cutting out huge niches of andesite out of cliffsides. And why do it? Why do it? They're cut in ways that aren't even blocks, because you don't see blocks that are made in this shape. So they remove diorite. Why? Like, I don't see the diorite they removed being incorporated into the structures, because the shape that they've removed it in isn't a block. It's like usually a trapezoid, this reverse trapezoid shape. It's just like, what's the purpose of it? Then is the niche the purpose? Not the removing of the stone, but the making of this alcove? And if so, why? And again, the amount of effort required to do that. Like, come on. Come on, people. It doesn't match. It does not match. Here is a great example of the First World Hunan Pacha work in the bedrock, and a copycat version of it done by the Second World megalithic builders, created in a way so that it could nearly be inserted right next to the bedrock carving, replicating its style. Why? What's the significance of this? I find these strange little niches fascinating because it would require so much more effort than it looks. This is a major undertaking. And although the perspective might be slightly off, I'm quite far away from that block. That's a large block of andesite that they've placed in there. And for what purpose? To put a pretty picture on the mountain? It just feels so much deeper than that. It feels so much deeper than that. It feels like a signpost, a signature, something important that is now completely being overlooked and surrounding it all across the cliffs. I mean, all across this entire area. We see these incredible stepped cuts into the bedrock. In fact, the more you look at this entire area, the more you see. From precision cuts and dressed walls to stone nubs in the bedrock and these reverse trapezoid niches. The whole cliffside is a mosaic of stone masonry, and yet not in ways that would appear typical for stone quarrying. Something else was going on here, and I don't think we've managed to figure it out yet. We see more examples of these Lego-like blocks, male and female connective elements that would fit together without binding agents. Just such an incredibly precise and sophisticated method of architectural engineering that has to be appreciated. I mean, whoever was truly creating these blocks had a knowledge far beyond what should have been available in antiquity. I don't think I have seen anywhere in Peru where the distinctive layers of different architecture are so clearly defined, because in Ollantaytambo, they are literally right next to each other. So again, we have all of this incredible bedrock work that is believed to have been of the First World, long before the Inca, long before our own history began. And then you have the Second World megalithic ashlar, more precise block building. The Nalpamachu, the first people in Andean lore, who were believed to have existed in a previous age and possessed greater knowledge and strength, but were destroyed by catastrophe. The same story we hear across the ancient world of global catastrophe and the existence of supernatural civilizer godlike beings that the ancients attribute as the megalithic stone builders and the bringers of knowledge into a post-cataclysmic world. It's really only the modern historical institutions approving interpretations that deem all of this fanciful and folklorish and unnecessary to explore in more detail. But when you do explore, you begin to see how these ancient mythologies may have had a more clearly defined place in real history than our current academic and historical institutions and models and frameworks will allow for. Comparing the work you see on this stone wall to the work we see here is simply not possible. They are night and day. It's the wall equivalent of a horse and cart being compared to a Ferrari. And here you can see where a piece of megalithic stone has been repurposed by the Inca for their own simpler wall constructions. And we see this time and time again, the repurposing of the megalithic work, but within reasonable and feasible levels. You don't see them lifting 50 to 100 ton blocks. They use blocks that a few strong men could have picked up. Again, things that were actually feasible for a Bronze Age civilization. Now, this next bit's very strange. It's not something that we see again, actually, not in Ollantaytambo or in any other site I visited. There are many of these alcoves in the bedrock. I've showed you several of them. Perhaps this is something that's present on all of them, but this is the only one that was easy enough to get up to. Now, admittedly, you're not really supposed to go up here and do this, but I did know about these marks already, and I just knew that I had to get high-quality 4K documenting of these particular signatures in the stone. I don't know what we're looking at here in terms of purpose, but these are laser-like straight lines etched into a pattern through solid diorite rock. That is incredible. I mean, you can't achieve these cuts with a copper or bronze chisel. Yet here they are, deep and precise grooves crisscrossing each other in this amazing symmetrical pattern. I don't know why this was done or what was used to do it. It's just a fascinating little hidden gem in Ollantaytambo that has never been recorded in this level of quality before. I think the Sacred Valley of Peru might be one of the most jaw-dropping areas of the world I've ever been to.